You're listening to Radio Aryan.
Oh, then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, tell me why you hurry so. Hush, you vocal, hush and listen, and his cheeks were all aglow. I bear orders from the captain, get you ready quick and soon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. Oh, then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, where the gathering is to be. In the old spot by the river, right well known to you and me. One word more for signal token, whistle up the marching tune. For your pike upon your shoulder, by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon. With your pike.
Greetings from the Northwest homeland, comrades. The date is Thursday, February 21st, 2019. I'm Andy Donner, and this is Radio Free Northwest.
For the blessed warming light, farmers passed along the valleys like the banshee's lonely croon, and the thousand blades were flushing at the rising of the moon, at the rising of the moon, at the rising of the moon.
I need to open my commentary on today's episode of Radio Free Northwest with a very upsetting announcement. For the foreseeable future, new physical copies of the Northwest Independence novels, as well as all of Harold Covington's other written works, will be unavailable on the market. Those handling Harold's affairs tell me it works like this. His will specified that upon his death, all of his copyrights go to the public domain. Those same people handling Harold's affairs were obligated to report to the self-publishing businesses this fact, as they were going about their business. Now, this was news to everybody here at the Northwest Front, but apparently the business model of these companies is that works which cannot pay out royalties simply cannot be self-published, because that's just not how these businesses go about doing what they do. Now, outside of that, I really don't understand a whole lot, since I'm certainly not a lawyer and I'm definitely not a copyright attorney. This is, of course, extremely unfortunate, and it is by no means the end of the matter, because the HQ group does have long-term plans to do what we can to make physical copies of these books available, though we're not quite sure how that's going to happen right now. In the meantime, his most important political works, the Northwest Independence Quintet, are available in PDF format for free on the party website. We understand that this is not what anybody wanted to happen, and we are not going to let that stand any longer than it has to. Your patience and understanding are appreciated. This last week, I actually had an epiphany about the subject of Radio Free Northwest and current events. It's been said time and time again that current events and news commentary is the pablum of the right wing, and the Northwest Front has to be different. By that very same logic, Radio Free Northwest covers current events as little as possible, simply because we don't need to duplicate the effort since we have other things that need said and done here. Even so, it turns out we actually do quite a bit of current events commentary, and I want to talk about that today. Truth be told, Radio Free Northwest actually covers current events all the time and in great depth. The thing is, we cover them years in advance. In the very early days of Radio Free Northwest, as well as subsequent years, Harold did a massive amount of spaced repetition on the idea of, quote-unquote, taking it all back. When this topic would come up, Harold would run down a quick analysis of what would happen if we were to elect a, quote-unquote, white nationalist president, or someone who is ever so slightly one of us, whatever that means these days. If you go back and listen to Harold's commentary on that matter and several other people's rehashings of the same thing in subsequent years on Radio Free Northwest, you'll find that our predictions were 100% accurate. Some months before Donald Trump announced his candidacy for president, Harold went on a very fascinating and darn prophetic monologue involving what will eventually happen in American politics, about how a man on a white horse will decide it's in his best interest to suddenly spout our positions for his own personal gain, and we should absolutely be aware that this man is a complete and total deceiver. Now, if that didn't describe Donald Trump to a T, I don't know what does. And it's doubly upsetting that essentially all of white nationalism, excepting the Northwest Front and several people that have been lumped into a category called White Nationalist 1.0s, who are not associated with the Northwest Front, managed to fall for that. We all know there were quite a few people opposed to Donald Trump on basic white nationalist principles, and I have to tip my hat to every single one of them, even if they despise us, because they took a correct principled stand and have been proven to be right in doing so. So to every single one of you, even if you're our ideological enemies, and yet are somehow in the movement, thank you for at least having some sort of moral stance. It does matter. Now, to the chagrin of economic doomsayers everywhere, I have to point out another one of Harold's observations that I think is absolutely 100% prophetic and relevant. We always have this idea that there's going to be some massive economic collapse that just shuts down Zog, and we all of a sudden turn into these badass Viking battle lords that are going to, again, somehow take it all back. The fact of the matter is, the system has a way of righting itself just at a lower level every single time. We absolutely cannot pin our hopes on external factors to secure the existence of our people and a future for white children simply because we have a very regrettable date with destiny and the point of no return demographically is fast approaching. It is most likely that the economic system, as well as every other part of the world system international Jewry wants to impose on us, will right itself at lower and lower levels, and we will run out the clock waiting for that. In response to that, Harold Covington and the Northwest Front pleaded with each and every one of us, week in and week out, for years, to not pin our hopes on that sort of event, but to rather deliberately put ourselves in a position to be of use to a functional revolutionary party to create an independent all-white nation here in the Pacific Northwest where it must be, or else it will fail. Nothing about that has changed, and nothing about that is going to change. White nationalism did not have to allow itself to be duped by Donald Trump, such that we put everything else we're doing to save our race on hold while we wait for him to pull a rabbit out of a hat. He's not going to do it. And even if I'm wrong about that, and he does pull something off, prior to his candidacy, we were all telling ourselves that the demographic damage was done and there isn't going to be a system politics solution to white genocide. Why it is we decided to throw out perfectly good reasoning and perfectly good understanding just because somebody came along and validated us with a bully pulpit, I'll never understand. Remember some weeks ago when I was on talking about the issue of self-validation and how white people, especially white young men, need to learn this, like, now? Well, there's a reason why. If you can self-validate, then you don't need somebody else's validation, and that means you don't need the validation of a charlatan like Donald Trump. Now, to all the economic doomsayers out there, it's true. The system is fundamentally unsound and will lead to a collapse, but we've predicted that collapse for decades now, collectively, as a group, and it hasn't come. We have every reason to believe, based on historical performance, that the system will right itself at lower and lower levels, simply waiting out white people's death, because there is an impending demographic doom for white people, and it will come prior to total system collapse. We don't have to wait for that. You can control your own thinking and your own planning. See if you yourself this week can't cover your own current events, but years in advance, in such a way that you actually land here in the homeland where you're supposed to be.
Hello everyone, Comrade Jason here with the helm for this week's RFN. As some of you will likely have noticed, every other show, Andy and I are batting RFN back and forth between us. We will continue to do so for the foreseeable future. This lowers the demands on his time, which, as you know, are already considerable, and helps make the work-intensive creative enterprise of producing the show sustainable over the long term. It's been working well, and I hope everyone has been enjoying the new content, as well as the replays of classic Harold Covington we pull in. To begin here, I'll continue a segment from our last original content RFN of 2 weeks ago. In that show, Andy played the first half of a roundtable discussion on a letter sent around in October to numerous people in the movement, which shared some thoughts on enclave building among racially loyal whites and mentioned the front and some of our activities over these past few years. Here's the second half of that discussion.
In the Northwest Independence novels, the Longview Conference and the treaty that came out of it, yes, it included Wyoming as part of the Northwest American Republic, but that was only as a token negotiating gesture on the part of the federal government. You know, just because they didn't really want it either, which is kind of dumb because there's a lot of good stuff in Wyoming. But anyway,
absolutely.
I think if
and
the time
we should
comes,
take it if we can.
We should take it if we can. Absolutely. We should take Alberta and British Columbia.
There's lots
if
of
we
Lebensraum
can.
In Wyoming.
Yes. Oh, yes, there is.
So
lots of good people
why would
there
we not
too, believe
that?
It or not. The quality
right.
of the people in Montana and Wyoming.
Yes.
Far better than anything we've got in Seattle.
One of the things I do want to say on some of the stuff he's got in here, he does make this comment, which is obviously true, when he's talking about white flight, et cetera, not excusing us from institution building and enclave making. We need to be prepared to thrive in all circumstances, regardless of minority or majority status. That's true. It's kind of obvious. But the thing is, we do need to kind of figure that out. From my perspective, when I read that, the thing that comes up in my mind is that some people have a greater need for social connectedness than others.
Mm-hmm.
I am not one that has a great need for social connectedness. I don't know whether that's a strength or a weakness. I don't know if that's the right characterization of either. Anyway, the way to look at it, it's just the fact I have less need for social connectedness. So those who have a greater need are going to be the ones, in my mind, to tell me what the answer is on how to build socially viable organizations and structures that are supportive of people and attractive to people and that can thrive. I don't know that I could do that. I could certainly be great within an organization like that. Maybe I could expand my skills to really understand how those things work and work really well. I think that I could. What I'm saying is it's not in my nature. We need to draw upon the strengths, the natural strengths that our people have and that individuals have. And so when Andy talked a little bit about his cynicism, maybe that's not the right word, but he's got a realistic attitude toward some of the things that he sees constantly from the movement that I do not. Maybe I'll become a little more jaded, a little less optimistic. But the email that I put out on the last RFN, people now have my email. It's comradejason_nf@outlook.com. I'm sure as people start to talk to me, I will start to see some of the things Andy does constantly and routinely, and I might be able to have a better perspective on what he's talking about with that. I guess what I'm really wanting to say here is he's bringing up a good point, which is we have not yet produced this enclave during Harold's tenure as leading and heading the front that he created. So part of our task as the party now and the headquarters group is to figure out just how to do that. Now, most of the folks here currently, I'll just say, are admitted introverts, not extreme introverts by any way, but you've got a tendency in your personality. I'm a somewhat extrovert, so we have a mix. We've got a mix philosophically, we've got a mix of backgrounds and a professional experience and training. And the thing is, we and you together will have to figure out exactly what it means to have a good community in the Northwest Front and to build that in a way that has not quite been done by the Front yet. We've had a lot of folks who have come in over the years, committed to their lives in the Northwest here, following Butler Plan, inspired by Harold and the vision that he laid out for all of us, and it can thrive extremely well. Harold himself admitted that he was probably not the man to pull that all together, and since he did have close hold on how the front operated and had very good reasons for that in terms of his concerns for security and other things like that, we have not generated that enclave here as yet. But I think that it could be done. People I've already met and have been described to me by these guys in the headquarters group already makes it very clear that the ground is very fertile and we've got the right people in place and involved. But what I would say is those who are well-suited and feel a greater need for connectedness amongst other people, they will know how to do that, and we need to draw upon their strengths. Because I'll tell you, I'm not the one to do that right now, simply because I don't need that. I enjoy it and benefit from it when other people have already created it, but I wouldn't be one of the ones to tell you how to do it.
One of the principles of management, particularly executive management, is to articulate a vision. That's supposed to be one of the primary jobs of executive management. And that is what Harold has done, certainly with his novels, has created this vision. And I think we should continue to do that, not just by promoting Harold's novels, although I think that's a great thing to do because his novels are superb for their purpose. I think also we should be creating this vision too. And I think that the challenge for us is to find ways for us to do it. Can we write short stories that build upon the novels? Can we make descriptions here that are appealing to people, that show them a future that they will find attractive and that they are willing to commit to? Things like this. We need practical methods to achieve our overarching goal. Certainly, creating a vision has been largely accomplished by Harold, although, again, I'll repeat myself, we should be continuing to do this as well as we move into the future. But that's the sort of thing that we need in terms of practical advice. What specifically do we need to do and how can we do it? And I think, unfortunately, this letter lacks that. And I think this is something that is central to the issue of how do we make progress? How do we move ahead? We need the clear and practical advice, clear and practical techniques, clear and practical jobs to be done.
Well, I completely agree with that. And this might be the last thing or the last that we might have one more go around about this letter and discuss other things. But on this fellow's second to last paragraph, there's something very interesting there. And he talks briefly about he himself is not a Christian identity, but he brings up a couple of Christian identity organizations as well as some various Mormon outfits as what he thinks is a good model. So I have to be fair to him that he's at least bringing up examples of what he thinks is a reasonable direction from his perspective. One thing that, and I guess I might be especially sensitive to this because I saw how Harold was criticized wrongly for so many years, and I got the bird's eye view of all that when I came home and started seeing what he had to wade through every day. But there's something here that I'll read to you, and it says, "Even Harold was challenged by not having a unicorn to make a simple brick and mortar happen. So," and he names a particular organization that he's referenced, "has surpassed even the best." Except that this organization he names happens to be religious, and it happens to be many decades old. And I guess this goes back to what Don said earlier, where this guy's contradicting himself and has very little content. And I would say, again, the subtext from this is that, why isn't this thing just happening? And bear in mind, religious organizations have nearly obligatory support to fund many employees. And when you have even a small organization of full-time employees that are secure in their funding, they can do a whole lot over a period of decades. And I guess that's my main frustration in all of this, is that even some of the criticism the front has had following Harold's death, a lot of that comes down to, yeah, I understand everybody's frustrated that things aren't happening faster or differently or to their expectations. But to that, I have two things to say. One, a lot of this is more difficult when we can't make it our full-time endeavor over a period, again, of decades. Harold did what he did because he was able to do, even as one person, he was able to do precisely what this guy is saying doesn't happen. Harold built himself a community or else the front would have collapsed.
That's correct.
This is the one thing I want to emphasize over and over again, is that whatever anybody else says about Harold and whatever anybody says about White Flight or the Northwest Front or anything related to enclave building is that it actually happened here. And you hearing our voices is proof of that. And two, the more important thing is, okay, if someone is genuinely concerned about this, they are perfectly free to do what we did, come here and help us out. Which, incidentally, is the one thing this guy says he's not going to do.
No, he's made a different decision, and that decision centers around what he does think is best for himself and his family on a personal basis with his relationship to his religion, to God, which can't really fault him for that. But it does smack of him taking off to have a decision that goes against the advice he's leaving behind in his wake for everyone else to take care of. I do understand the annoyance of these guys toward this attitude.
Well, that's something we have no time for, because it's the precise opposite of what we as individuals did. I have to emphasize this one more time. We actually did the community building that he's talking about, and he's saying, here's how it happens, and the whole do as I say, not as I do thing, that's the exact opposite of the Northwest Front's MO. Yes.
And to make the point even stronger, what he's doing is counterproductive, because he's encouraging people to, wherever they are outside of the homeland, to create communities there instead of moving to the homeland and creating the communities in the homeland where we need them.
And he says
that's preventing people from moving to the homeland.
And he says that with one breath, and in other parts of his letter, he immediately says, but I understand that people have to leave where they are because it might not be safe for white people. You know, AJ at one point said he thinks this whole thing is just one big exercise in projection, and that may be. Again, this might be my perspective more so than someone else's, but reading it, it kind of just builds up to his announcement that we're not going to do any of this, so there. I think that's why it's so double-minded the whole way through. I think he's just verbalizing his own rationale for abandoning what he thinks needs to happen.
Yes, well, everyone listening doesn't really have this letter in front of us and can't really reference it and understand it in the detail that we do. I think that may be enough of kind of picking him apart on this. We did really want to use this as a springboard to some of the important issues around enclave building, connectedness, how to form those communities and such. When I talked about it not really having happened under Harold's watch and tenure and guidance of the front that he created, we understand a close-knit community is something that's very hard to create, and we all have different visions of what that means. There is an enclave of sorts, certainly here, successful beyond what anyone else really in the white nationalist movement has ever produced. Now, I don't want to say that my appreciation for that is not on a par with these guys here, too, because they did point that out directly. I'm here because of it. Other people are here because of it. You may not hear their voices as much, but we know who they are. We do associate and socialize with them, have a good time with them. These guys especially, I'm learning who all is here in the headquarters area. But the point is, it has been done here. It is being done. If we want to take it to the next level, some folks who know a little more about that than perhaps I do, and some of the others, like I say, the folks who really understand connectedness, maybe through their own church that they've had in their lives, other fraternal organizations. I've never been a member of a fraternal organization. I only have the vaguest ideas of how they are maintained, their cohesion is kept together. So I couldn't talk about that. Folks who have some experience with that, putting together social organizations, social events, keeping people informed, keeping communication flowing, those kinds of skills are very valuable.
this group here has some good stuff with that. Internally, as a headquarters group, we do that extremely well. So other folks who do that on a larger social scale that are part of the party and the intent of the Northwest Front and the Butler Plan and the imperative, those folks, we would really benefit from them stepping up a bit to maybe make this happen.
So I completely agree with that. And Don, do you have any closing thoughts on this matter?
Well, I think that one of the relevant issues is something that I raised before we began recording, and that is that people in Europe have the advantage of cultural, ethnic homogeneity that is lacking in the United States. The United States is made up of people from many countries, and I'm just talking about the white population from many countries in Europe. And the tightness is missing that's present in uniform ethnic groups. For example, in Baltimore back in the day when in the 60s and blacks were rioting, they didn't cross this street because on the other side of the street was where Little Italy began. And that kind of ethnic solidarity and protectiveness is not something that Americans in general share. And I think that's a clear example of why we should be open, in my mind, to ethnic groups, white ethnic groups, of course, forming their own little communities, and that we should encourage this, because if we don't, we're losing that cohesiveness that's available to a single country, single ethnic groups of people, and that this ethnic organizing principle will maybe be strong enough to pull in the more global white community within the Northwest to create the Northwest American Republic.
So something that this letter hinted at, and Jason, I think, was fair when we were discussing what this letter really meant, he pointed out that, okay, look, the letter said, why look backwards? We're going to have to look forwards anyway. And Jason was absolutely right, and he said quite a bit of it here that you've all heard. And his thought was, okay, yeah, we're going to have to look to the future. So people who know about this and think this is what we should focus on, we're open to listening to you on that. And I say that sincerely. I mean that because, obviously, I previously thought the Northwest Imperative was nuts until I actually sat down to consider it and decided I was wrong about all that and needed to get involved. And what I will say before closing this part of our discussion, before going on to the other things Jason mentioned, is that my policy and my advice that I've always given people sincerely is that, like the author of this letter, even though he's chosen to go a different route, people will frequently approach the Northwest Front with an idea or a concern or a project, and quite a lot of the time, these are genuinely good ideas. We ourselves just can't do them. And what I will say to all of you out there, if this has piqued your interest, when you notice something, that's usually a good hint that you're the person who should be fixing it. And so I will once again reiterate the call to, if you're genuinely concerned about the Northwest Imperative and the Butler Plan, please take this advice as we're giving it, emulate our behavior, come here, get involved, and if this is something you want to help out with, feel free because we're genuinely interested.
Good evening, comrades. Tonight I'm going to be discussing Made in Russia, The Holocaust, by Carlos Whitlock Porter. Now, this is the last of the four books in the Last Box Tribute series, and it represents a subject that has been a considerable reluctance on my part. Now, personally, I avoid delving into theories about the Holocaust. I have many reasons for this. The subject has a tendency to become obsessive for some in our movement, and like all obsessions, it prevents current real engagement in modern issues. Believing in a theory of innocence can, as it did for Rockwell, serve as a prerequisite for ideology. But the problem with this is that this prerequisite could be reversed if an individual should be persuaded otherwise. Conversely, a belief in guilt may very well attract sadomasochistic individuals who take a perverse pleasure in such things. Also, too, of course, Holocaust denial, as it is called, violates certain EU laws. This can result in individuals being banned from certain countries, and of course, this creates a further alienation from ethnic homelands. Because all of this is unproductive, it is my policy to take no position on the question of camps established by the Reich during World War II. Therefore, any views expressed are Porter's, or possibly the late Harold, presumably, since this may have been his book, or at least a book that he endorsed. Porter believes that the Holocaust, as we understand it, is created by questionable paperwork and photos, and the author implies that this was produced by Soviets who wished to blame Germans for things that they themselves had actually done. When the Soviets destroyed churches or engaged in various massacres such as Katyn. Now, at Nuremberg, the author argues that documents of confession are either not genuine or that they were coerced, and also, too, that once these documents came to be available, they were just requoted. Now, Porter certainly acknowledges that there were some prisoners in these camps that did lose a great deal of weight due to illness. But he notes that even late in the war, for example, even in mid-April of 1945, he claims that most of the inmates at Buchenwald were healthy, and in some cases he even states that they were plump. The author also notes that Bergen-Belsen was actually burned, and he believes that this was due to the fact that there was a lot of disease there, and there was a fear that the disease could spread. Now, the author notes that the defendants had very little chance to read the various testimonies and mount a defense. For example, there were only two copies, and they would be available for 25 defendants, and they would have also arrived 1/2 hour late. Also, too, there's a question of translations, especially with numbers. Sometimes these numbers were spoken so quickly that they were not well understood or that they were grossly mistranslated. Also, sometimes defendants feared for their family, so they were coerced into signing various documents. The author argues that in contrast to what is presented, the German military was actually under strict guidelines, and if there was any misconduct, then they were at the very least imprisoned. Wounded prisoners were treated like any other wounded, and if need be, the Germans would get fewer rations when food supplies were running low. Now, the author also says that plundering was prohibited, and even when destruction was ordered, it was not carried out. Any commander who was found to be mistreating prisoners, the author argued, would be executed. Now, the author talks about a witness who visited Buchenwald in July of 1943, for example, and found an agreeable facility, although it is noted that the inmates did work hard, but they also had many amenities such as sports and shows. Now, the author notes, too, that the camps would not have had enough ovens for the purposes that were claimed. The author also writes about the various medical experiments that were said to be carried out, and he finds them unscientific and preposterous. The author also talks about how an industrialized nation would not have any need for certain byproducts of deceased persons. And the author really tells us that the contemporary view that we have of the Holocaust was really shaped by a filmmaker by the name of Sergei Eisenstein. And this was somebody who was a very enthusiastic communist, made a lot of films for Russia, and they really dramatized this idea of the camps being these horrible places that we now think of them as being today. And this author seems to have the belief, which is but maybe a little hard to believe, actually, that the conditions in the camps remained good, even late in the war. Now, when Porter shows these pictures of healthy-looking inmates, he doesn't question the authenticity of these photos. Now, to counter-argue Porter, it is widely believed that the National Socialists would make films or pictures of these camps that would portray a very rosy picture of the camps in order to reassure various officials who had not visited the camps that everything was going well and everything was fairly normal at these camps. However, other people argue that the camps were visited by the Red Cross and that the Red Cross never found the conditions to be unsuitable at these various camps. Now, Porter renounced his American citizenship back in the early 1980s and since has used a passport marked stateless. Now, this could well be due to his views. One important question for us to ask is whether these ideas would really help to red pill anyone. Now, the topic is unsavory, so many would be turned off at the face of it. And the question of treatment at these camps is no longer the most pressing question in present day. I honestly question to what extent work like this is helpful. Also, too, Porter does not ever note a question of families being transferred to camps, if indeed he believes that happened. I don't know that he does. He also admits that work was hard, so the question of those who might be unable to engage in hard labor doesn't quite seem to necessarily be answered. So, one of the things we might ask ourselves is a certain disposition of Germans in aggregate. Now, certainly we know that Germans are industrious and energetic, so that could argue towards a certain amount of guilt. But the author asks the question whether they are genuinely cruel. And the author doesn't really believe that Germans are capable of the kind of conduct described in the Holocaust. And he argues this type of conduct is really more Russian. Now, this is a question that could bring us to a certain degree of meditation. However, at the end of the day, I feel the negative aspect of taking a revisionist position far outweighs the benefit of taking a neutral or even slightly conciliatory view of this question. At the end of the day, I think there is no point in incurring any more illegalities or unhealthy personal obsessions. It's just that I fear that this topic tends to, or has, at least in the past, absorbed individuals who had some or would have had some sympathy with our movement, and instead of engaging them in productive and more current concerns, instead they remain stuck in this mire or this quicksand of the topic of the Holocaust. And that is why I find this topic highly problematic. Also, too, it could be argued that believing in the Holocaust and supporting the movement anyway could certainly be seen as a Nietzschean test of personal will. However, I must admit that believing in the Holocaust is, of course, a heavy burden. So that sort of viewpoint will, of course, depend on individual temperament and interests. So, I thank you for listening to this discussion, and I hope you found it interesting. So have a good evening, and hail victory, comrades.
On a recent episode of RFN, we received a question from a new female listener that I want to answer. She wrote, I've listened to a few of your shows, but I have yet to hear about what the women in the movement of white well-being can be doing other than having babies and caring for family. Perhaps in a future show you can address what our women can be doing, also our older generation who have passion but lack connections to the inner circles. The roles and contributions of the sexes in the movement have long been debated, and this is an area of natural interest to all of us. This new listener's question is a good springboard into the entire subject. It has been addressed before on RFN, and I've gone into the archives and found a good segment on this broader topic. There's more here than just an answer to this specific question, but after we hear from Harold and some of our female party members from 2015, I'll add my thoughts on answering her question directly, and then we'll close out the show.
I got an email here from a longtime female party associate, Comrade Kate, who's been with us for many years from the time I was living down in Astoria. At our last meeting, a subject came up that she clearly had ideas on, and she agreed to do a submission for the program on the topic. Now, although Kate has, in fact, appeared on Radio Free Northwest before, many years ago, I'm familiar with this lady's personal situation, and for various reasons, I am not comfortable with actually putting her voice on here at this time. So I'm actually going to read this commentary myself. Dear Harold, this is something I said I'd send you before we meet next, but I had a hard time in finding the words to express what I feel, and what was supposed to be a discussion starter felt more like a bad essay. Here it is, although hopefully as a conversation starter. A woman's view of displacement of white males in the workplace. I hear white men complain that economic downturns, diversity quotas, and political correctness have made higher-wage jobs hard for them to find and keep. As a woman, I experience these problems in a different way. In my ideal world, women would choose to focus most of their energy on homemaking and take on employment outside the home only if they wish. In my reality, I work to keep my family afloat and focus energy on developing my career for long-term security. This messes with me on a visceral level, among the things I struggle with. Emasculation of white men. I believe it's natural for the man to be the king of his household with a family that looks up to, respects, and obeys him. Being obedient to a man doesn't make a woman a second-class citizen. It makes an effective partnership. It chips away at a man's sense of masculinity when a woman has to function as the head of the household. I've been the breadwinner during most of my relationship and have sometimes been the only one with an income. My man handles it really well, but I can sense the hurt. Cheating my family out of a wife and mother. Living in a safer community while pursuing higher pay in the big city means longer commutes, and that cuts into time with my family. I don't have energy left at the end of the day to be a gourmet cook or keep our home beautiful. Sometimes I feel like half a woman. Interacting with non-white men at work. Maintaining a professional image when working with the opposite sex can be a challenge, and working with foreign-born men makes it even more complicated. Different cultures have different norms. Taking the time to understand their norms and act accordingly means I focus less on the job at hand. I know other women and their families struggle with these things and more. It would be interesting to hear their stories and to also know how men deal with the advantage we women have as a protected class when it comes to employment. Signed, Kate. Okay, ladies, how about it? Let us hear from you, preferably in an MP3 audio file, about how life in Obama's America is treating you and how you're surviving.
I've been hearing a lot about white privilege lately.
About how white women have things so much easier than every other people.
That because of the color of my skin, things are simply handed to me.
I guess we have the privilege of having unwanted immigration forced into our lands, being hated and blamed for all of the world's problems.
And footing the bill for all of it.
I guess we have the privilege of being enslaved to the Barbary pirates,
Ottoman Turks,
and countless others throughout history.
And that privilege still carries over to today. I guess we also had the privilege of having our myths, legends, and folktales culturally appropriated by non-whites.
White women of childbearing age are only 2% of the world's population.
Yet we are encouraged to breed outside of our race.
Or forfeit having children altogether.
Because we'll just be adding more racist carbon consumers to the world.
White women are attacked just for walking down the street.
1 in 4 Swedish women will be raped in her lifetime. And she's not being raped by other Swedes.
White women are being raped in broad daylight.
While onlookers do nothing.
White women are currently enslaved in Israel.
And raped repeatedly.
Day and night. without any hope for escape.
We are actually told that a white woman can't be raped because she is the oppressor, and oppressors can't be raped.
We are victims of hate crime, but the world falls silent. No one seems to care when it happens to a white person.
The world applauds as our race dies.
And our people's souls are broken.
Femen, funded by the Jew George Soros, pits white women against their own men. Taught to hate our fathers and despise our brothers through relentless bashing of the hetero white male. They advocate for Islam, a religion that cuts off the clitorises of little girls and requires their women to be covered from head to toe.
Yet they are marching around bare-breasted? What is going on?
The media programs women into thinking the Sex and the City lifestyle is ideal.
And traditional gender roles are oppressive and backwards.
We are taught by Jewish feminists that motherhood is oppressive and that we need to leave the house to go work in a cubicle, a strip club, or wait tables for mindless consumers and serve anyone but our own family.
This is freedom from oppression?
Wake up. A war is being waged against you. It is time to finally take action.
We will not accept the anti-white lies and propaganda put forth by the media.
We will not stand by and watch as our people are shamed and demoralized and as our countries are ruined.
We will not be collectively punished for the supposed sins of our ancestors. Learn about the real history of our people. Not the vicious lies inserted into our books, TV shows, magazines, and movies.
Question the mainstream narrative. Research white genocide.
Demand justice for our folk.
Have the uncomfortable conversation with your family about racial realities. We're running out of time.
We need you.
That was a good segment. I particularly like this last piece comprised of only women's voices, speaking powerfully and with precision. It illustrates exactly how courageous, racially loyal white women need to learn to talk to one another and to those of our people who have not yet been awakened. If your race is at the core of your value system, then we need you to let other white people know that. Most people are followers. Get them to follow you in this most critical of social issues, recovering our awareness of the central importance of race to the functioning of society. If you are racially aware and loyal to our race in today's America, you are mentally and emotionally healthier than our unaware white brothers and sisters. You are ahead of the curve, and each of us who is blessed to enjoy this greater and clearer understanding has a responsibility to spread it to others. Women can do this as well as men, and have the innate potential to do so even more effectively than men, through the social networks that women form more naturally than men do, and as inspiration to the male half of the species. Because healthy, especially young men, are always paying attention to our race's women. Most people in the movement know and readily accept that men and women are mentally and emotionally different in many ways, although temperament and aptitudes in individuals are so varied that there really is a lot of overlap between the two. In general, however, I think it is easy to notice that, as a rule, it is the men who tame the world and create civilization, while women care for it and basically make it worth having in the first place. I will readily admit that if not for women, I simply wouldn't bother to do half the things I do to advance my own circumstances or that of my fellow man. So in terms of motivation for men, the main builders of society and civilization, women are utterly essential in their extremely powerful role as companions, advisors, and the origin of the male desire to dominate the natural world and provide for family and the future. As said in the Bhagavad Gita, which is an ancient text of our people, the Aryan invaders who conquered and brought advanced civilization to the Indian subcontinent, out of the corruption of women proceeds the corruption of races. Out of the corruption of races, the loss of memory. Out of the loss of memory, the loss of understanding. And out of this, all evil. Women are the central cohesive force keeping the testosterone-fueled forces of destruction and reconstruction of men in check, and helping harness our energies into productive lines. The social and racial health of our women is all important. Men have a role in protecting women, but women have the greater ability to either protect or corrupt society overall through their loyalties, attachments, and love for what is good and beautiful and noble, or their rejection of the same. This is precisely why Hollywood Jews are so adamant about working to undermine and corrupt the loyalties and natural attachments of white women, especially to race and family, by promoting material selfishness in female characters, injecting gratuitous race mixing and interracial relationships in every single show today, depicting constant conflict between male and female characters, and almost never showing highly functional white family relationships. The bottom line is that, yes, the family and social responsibilities of the female sex are their biggest and most important ones, and overall, these should command the bulk of their attention and energy. It is essential to our social and racial health. And in normal, sane, white societies that have not been corrupted by the presence of constant Jewish propaganda, women choose to do so naturally. Beyond this, however, today, when even the common man is blessed with more abundant resources and time than our forefathers and mothers ever enjoyed, if the essentials of family and social connection are taken care of in society, there is simply no reason women can't choose any other role for themselves in addition. Men should encourage women to be all that they can be, as they should encourage us in the same way. Men and women are together in life and in all things. As for our older generations, the need for them to speak to the needs and loyalties of our people is just as great as from any other generation. Senior white men and women can also come here, join the front, and do what they can. Comrade Don, in his 70s, is one of the cornerstones of the NF headquarters group and was long a confidant of Mr. Covington's and has been here aiding the front directly for more than 5 years. So in answer to this new listener's question, I would say that, after a woman takes care of the most important thing that we collectively have to do, which is to raise mentally and emotionally healthy white children who also have an appreciation for their race, our glorious history, and our unlimited future, and after she finds some role in the critical general task of building community and social cohesion for all of us, with whatever energy, enthusiasm, and time she has left over, she can do whatever it is that interests her that she sees anyone else doing, woman or man. And each of the rest of us should encourage and help her as we are able. We do not fight with and badger one another needlessly, and we bring one another up instead of pushing each other down to claim our own spot or to get people around us to do things precisely the way we think they should be done. We work together as adults with an eye on our collective future. It is destructive to cast the natural differences between men and women and their differing general preferences as wrong, and to try to undermine them and corrupt them as has been done in the present day. However, I think it is also wrong to shoehorn people into roles for which neither nature nor their mental and emotional development in life may have suited them. Let each man choose the role that best suits his talents and natural capabilities and inclinations, and each woman. This is the best and most efficient use of our people's genius, and every one of ours individually. Whites are moving into an existential survival situation on this planet, which requires enlisting the enthusiasm and dedication from every racially loyal white person into the cause, in whatever role most calls to them. We cannot afford to waste the talent, enthusiasm, or dedication of any loyal white man or woman by trying to unnecessarily corral his or her efforts into our own personal narrow vision of what they should be doing. All who want to work for the collective benefit of our people should be encouraged to do so in whatever way they think they can. If you are someone who can hear this message and you find working with like-minded, mature, serious white men and women who want to change the world, then you need to come to the homeland, join us, and help make it happen. Have a great week, comrades. Thanks for listening.
Radio Free Northwest is brought to you by the Northwest Front. P.O. Box 2188, Bremerton, Washington, 98310. You can visit the party on our website at www.northwestfront.org. Until next week, comrades, hail victory.
Oh, what glorious pride of sorrow fill the name of 98. Yet, thank God, it still is beating heart in my heart's burning new. Who could follow in their footsteps of the rising of the moon?
gone.